This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 129, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 120 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Mike Ricksecker about his book, Travels Through Time, Inside the Fourth Dimension, Time Travel, and Stacked Time Theory. Mike is a best-selling author. He has appeared on multiple television shows and programs, including History Channel's Ancient Aliens and The Unexplained, Travel Channel's The Alaska Triangle, Discovery Plus's Fright Club, Animal Planet's The Haunted, and multiple series on Gaia TV. For more than 6 years, he hosted the Edge of the Rabbit Hole livestream show and currently hosts the Connecting the Universe interactive class. Hi, Mike. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely, Simon. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Travels Through Time, Inside the Fourth Dimension, Time Travel, and Stacked Time Theory. I wanted to ask you about what are the weird things around time that relate to UFOs?
Well, you know, there are a number of things. For one, a lot of people refer to the time loss incidents that happen around abduction cases. And to me, this is really a very fascinating aspect of the phenomenon, because we actually see in abduction scenarios throughout time, as it were, in which, you know, somebody has been taken somewhere. And we see this, you know, 150 years ago, we were talking about this in the fairy realm, you know, 150, 200, 250 years ago, with a lot of legends that came out of like Ireland, Wales, England, Scotland, you know, that region where, you know, the fairies were abducting people into some other realm. And these days, now this is attributed to extraterrestrials and UFOs. We can take this back to the Betty and Barney Hill case, where, you know, all of a sudden they had 2 hours of their life suddenly missing. Or you look at Travis Walton. He thought when he reappeared, it was the same night that he had gone missing, and it had been 5 days. So what is happening when these people are taken away? Well, if we look into the possibility that some of these extraterrestrial craft are traveling interdimensionally, in other words, instead of using our classic Newtonian physics to traverse across the universe, maybe they are using some sort of portal through other dimensions or wormholes and this sort of thing. So if they are taking somebody to another dimension, if that is where their actual craft is, and that is maybe it's sitting in the fifth, sixth, seventh dimension. We have up to 11 hyperspatial dimensions. If it's sitting in one of those other dimensions, it would be outside the dimension of time, which is the fourth dimension. And so therefore, what we consider to be time would work differently in those other dimensions. So if that is where people are being taken, then just very naturally, time is going to work differently. And their perception of how time has passed will be very different than here on Earth in the fourth dimension.
Yeah, because I've heard people describe this missing time phenomenon, and they kind of say that they're in one place and then a split second later they're in another place, and there's no perception of anything actually happening. It's an instant change. Then they've noticed the loss of time. It might be, you know, like the ETs are doing something to you psychologically, messing with your memory as well as messing with time.
Well, there would be that aspect too. How much of it is just in the natural course of, you know, if they're doing experimentation on the person like we see with Betty and Barney Hill, you know, how much of that was, you know, maybe they were knocked out for a while. You know, maybe they were comatose and they had no idea, they couldn't perceive that passage of time to begin with. So it might be a mixture of some of these different things. But then you hear stories of my book, Alaska's Mysterious Triangle. I chronicled this, where in 2006, there was a boy who just, he appeared on the side of Pilcher Mountain. And there were some hunters that were up there. And this was, there's still snow on the ground. And when he just kind of appeared there, they're looking at him like, where did this kid come from? And there are no tracks in the snow around him. He just basically appeared right there. And so, you know, they got him to safety and took him to the, you know, basically the authorities, tracked down his family and all that. But the account that he gave was that he was basically abducted and taken captive by these little beings that in the traditional Inuit lore are called the Irchinhat. But, you know, they're basically small humanoid type beings. And they took him inside the mountain. And while he was there, he met this girl and they chatted for a while, spent some time together. And he's not really sure how much time he spent there. But when he spoke to the girl told him that she had been there for something like 40 years. Now, she's still a girl. So, you know, obviously time had not passed on her being because she still looked to be a young girl, even though she was claiming to have been there for 40 years. And all of a sudden, you know, the Irchinhat decided that they didn't need him. They didn't want him, whatever the decision that was made there to take him back outside and put him back into our world. So, you know, some really, really fascinating cases about how time works differently in these abduction scenarios.
And so there's this thing with Jim Penniston at Rendlesham where he kind of touched the craft and I think he had a download and that was that binary code which was later kind of decoded. So what's this whole thing with Jim Penniston? What does he say about time travel and the UFOs?
Yeah, that was very interesting. Rendlesham Forest incident, early 1980s, I think it was 1980 specifically, if I recall. He called it like the sphere of influence. So when he touched that craft, well, he got that download, but really even before that, he kind of looked around and the others that were near him, like Burroughs and Kabanseg, they had basically, it looked like they had stopped in their tracks, that they were completely still. And, you know, come to find out after all of this had transpired, his time was off by 45 minutes. So something happened when he got near the craft where time seemed to work differently. And yeah, I believe when he looked back at the other guys that they were still, you know, operating on their time, but to him, because he was in this bubble, for lack of a better term, time was working differently around the craft. And so to him, to Jim Penniston, it looked like they had just completely locked into place. But that was just because of the nature of time and how it was working around that craft. But yeah, it was something like a 45-minute difference.
So for the people outside that bubble, maybe 10 seconds passed, but for him, 45 minutes.
Right, yeah. Yeah, they experienced time differently.
It's weird, it's some kind of relativity thing. You need a huge amount of gravity to make that kind of change, don't you?
Well, I mean, it can be a number of different things. I mean, it's going to take some sort of energy. Gravity could certainly come into play in that. You know, when we're talking other dimensions, you know, we're talking different frequencies, really. So, you know, when we see different things morph in and out of our plane of existence, these are on all different frequencies and they have their own, personal energetic resonance to them. So as humans, you know, there are a lot of different factors at play. So we have our own personal standing resonance, which is anywhere between 9 to 16 hertz. Our eyes only see into certain wavelengths. You know, we only hear on certain wavelengths. So if you take things that are outside of that, beyond it, you know, those things are still going on around us. We don't normally see and interact with them. But when they are manipulated like that, then, yeah, we can have these different fluctuations in time and experiences with other realities.
And we hear about the incredible maneuvers that these craft can do, going from 0 to 1,000 miles an hour in a split second or changing direction at a 90-degree angle without slowing down. So I wonder if they're able to change time for themselves in the craft and around the craft. So It looks to us like they're going 0 to 1,000, but actually for them, it's taking 30 seconds to make that acceleration.
Right. It could very well be. We're talking about something that's on a different frequency, something that's in another dimension, and we're just getting a glimpse of it. You're right. It could be taking much longer time on their plane of existence to be making that maneuver. And you have the idea that some of these are, time travelers, that they are ourselves from another point in time, another point in the future. And when it comes to that notion, I don't discredit it. I think some of them certainly could be. But you look down the road into the future of our planet, and we've got about another 5 billion years to exist here on planet Earth. So these could be, sure, indigenous to Earth in the future, but they don't necessarily have to be human. They could be another advanced civilization that has evolved long after we are gone, or even an extraterrestrial civilization that has come here millions of years down the road and has colonized, and they've figured out the secrets to time travel. So yeah, they could be craft that are certainly indigenous to Earth from the future, from another point in time, or simply within another dimension here around us right now at this point in time, which is another dimensional plane.
And there's that suggestion that they may be coming to collect DNA because they've messed up in the future with, cloning or something, and they need the original DNA from us to fix themselves.
Yeah, there are those ideas, and I don't know if we really know specifically for sure whether that's the case. We see that in a lot of science fiction storylines, but it makes sense. Why would people from the future come here and interact with us and conduct experimentation on us? There's something that they want to know. There's some knowledge that they need. And it could very well be that they've done something to ruin the future and need to extract something from us to try to fix that. A lot of them are watching and observing. Some of them, many of them, we really don't have any interactions with. And we just kind of see them watching and observing. And those are, to me, almost like researchers, something that we would do if we went to some other planet or went to some other point in time. I don't necessarily know if we would really interact with it for fear of changing something, but I think we would want to study. And so we see a lot of that happening too.
So you talk about paradoxes in the book, but one I wanted to ask you about right now is the Fermi paradox. And what do you make of that? Do you think that's false, that it doesn't really apply?
Well, yeah, it's perspective to me. Basically, for the listeners that are not familiar with the Fermi paradox, it's this idea that we believe that there is life elsewhere in the universe without having proof that there is life elsewhere in the universe. Intelligent life. Now, many people who have had their own UFO encounters and extraterrestrial encounters, of course, would argue that. But from the traditional scientific community, they state we have not yet had any interaction with an intelligent extraterrestrial life form. So therefore, how can we say it's out there? And I say it's perspective in math. We have this arrogant perspective of ourselves that everything outside of our planet is extraterrestrial. However, to the entire rest of the universe, we are the extraterrestrials. And so, therefore, looking at it from a universal viewpoint, there is, we know, at least one planet with intelligent life, and that is us. In our galaxy, the Milky Way. So if you were to just, and given that we have approximately 400 billion stars, you calculate that out. Okay, say here's the ratio. One for every 400 billion stars, we know that there is a planet with life on it. And I think it's 27 zeros after it of the approximate stars that we have in the universe. So you can basically calculate that out, that there are billions of planets out there that would have some sort of intelligent life on it. And that number is not even accurate anymore, because once the James Webb telescope started looking to the deep reaches of the universe, the scientists were a bit surprised and shocked. I'm not shocked, but they were surprised and shocked to realize, oh, there's a lot more out there than we originally anticipated. In other words, more galaxies, more stars, more systems that, you know, have the chance of having life. So yeah, that's just perspective in math.
I suppose you could look at it and think, well, if there's one planet with life in each galaxy, there's still billions of galaxies with one life form in each galaxy. So that's still billions, isn't it?
Right, exactly. That's exactly it.
I suppose there's an idea, though, that how long does it take for a society to evolve and become civilized and reach the state where they could travel by interstellar to different planets, whether it's interdimensionally or just going through space, and then that civilization ending for some reason. And the thing is, the window that they're alive could be so far away from the window that we're alive. They could have done that millions of years ago and died out. And so what are the chances of two intelligent civilizations being around at the same time through all these billions of years?
Yeah, I mean, the rest of the universe has had a 9 billion year head start on us. So there have been plenty of civilizations out there that have risen up, lived out their existence, and have since died off. Many of them are still out there, and there will be many more that will come to rise. So, the idea that there are other civilizations out there that have developed technology to be able to traverse the stars is, of course, completely feasible. And the methodology that they would be using to be able to do that, you know, they've had so much time to be able to develop that they could very well be using systems that we're not aware of. They probably have some sort of anti-gravity technology. They have probably figured out the secrets to the Einstein-Rosen bridge. They've probably figured out secrets that we haven't even thought of yet of how to traverse the cosmos. We're still relatively young in our spacefaring civilization. You know, it's really only been, we started putting things up back in the 1950s. Rocketry, you know, theoretically was starting to be developed back in the 1890s. But really at a more cohesive level, back during World War II with the V2 and all that. So you're talking less than 100 years ago. So we are still really early in this game. We've come a long way in those 100 years, but you know, we're talking now about returning to the moon, missions to Mars. You know, that's going to be over the next 10, 20, 30 years. And we need to, and I'm all for it. I know a lot of people will say, well, we need to take care of ourselves here on the planet. Yes, we do. But there's a happy medium. We have to, at some point, traverse the cosmos. We have to be a spacefaring civilization, because at some point, I already mentioned it earlier, at some point, this planet isn't going to be around anymore. You know, the sun will become a red giant, encompass the Earth, and will destroy us. So at some point, if we want human civilization to survive, we need to push ourselves out into the universe. And it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen during my lifetime. But in future generations, it will be something that that can and will happen. And we need to do it.
And I think you mentioned scientists maybe 100, 120 years ago who basically said, we know everything there is to know about physics now. We just need to get the finer measurements done. And that, to me, relates to this argument of saying the UFOs can't be here because there's too much distance between the stars. There's no way they'd be able to get here. But that's the same sort of thing as saying, oh, we know everything about physics, so we can be absolutely sure no one can build a craft that can do that.
Yeah, it's to me, it's the arrogance of humanity. We always think that we are at the peak. We're always at the height of our civilization. just like right now, and a little off topic from this, but related, when we talk about the idea of the simulated universe, that, you know, has to be a computer. And we think that because that is, you know, the height of our technology right now. But there are technologies, obviously, going back to that, that they had no concept of back then. So it was a very arrogant statement and a very naive statement for them to make back then, just like anybody thinking that now, you know, would also be arrogant and naive to make that sort of statement. There are technologies that we have yet to discover that will completely revolutionize our planet, that will revolutionize our civilization, that these other civilizations that are out there in the universe have probably long since discovered and are already utilizing.
I wanted to ask you about shadow people and how they might relate to the UFO phenomena. Mm-hmm. But first of all, could you tell us what happened to you when you were 8 years old, that experience you had?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this is really where I got my start. I'm an experiencer. And so, you know, first significant, what I call paranormal incident that I had was, like you said, I was about 8 years old, woke up in the middle of the night one night, and there was this tall, dark figure standing in the corner of my bedroom. Now, I didn't immediately think shadow person or anything like that. I thought there was an intruder in the house. Somebody had broken in and was looking to steal something or, God forbid, kill me. You know, it did flash through my mind that I had about enough time to gasp and, you know, that was it. I was going to be a goner. I'd seen enough movies and television shows that, you know, my mind started spinning as to what might happen. But that didn't happen. Obviously, I'm still alive to tell the tale, which is great. but it did get physical with me. This thing approached my bed, leaned over, and I'm trying to scream. You know, my mouth opened up and nothing could come out because I was just too terrified. And I'm just staring into this blank, black face. There's nothing there. No eyes, no nose, no mouth, nothing there. And as it leaned over, it grabbed me by the wrists, crossed my arms across my body, and then ran off down the hall. By that point, I found my voice, found my legs, ran off screaming to my parents' bedroom, you know, telling them what had happened. They were trying to, I have nice parents. They're trying to console me, calm me down, trying to tell me that I had just had a bad dream. But, you know, I knew I hadn't had a bad dream. I'd been awake for this entire incident. Some years back, I had a hypnotic regression to try to figure out exactly what had happened here. I'd experienced several other shadow entities and things like that since then. You know, I was a paranormal investigator for quite a while, so I had other experiences there. But this first one always haunted me. I wanted to find out exactly what happened. Other people that I talked to started, you know, throwing out other interesting suggestions, like, you know, maybe it was some sort of time traveler and saw me lying there, maybe thought I was dead and was putting me into a burial pose, like, you know, something out of ancient Egypt, crook and flail sort of things. Like, okay, that's an interesting idea. But I wanted to find out exactly what had happened. So during this hypnosis session, and I'm not going to get into all the details, it's kind of a long story, but just to kind of sum it up, the hypnotherapist was able to actually channel the being itself. And I got to see the entire incident from the perspective of the being. So it was, you know, during this hypnosis session, I was actually looking down at my little 8-year-old self, which was truly fascinating. And I also got to feel the emotions of the being because she was like truly channeling this thing. And, you know, I got to feel that once it realized that that I could see it and it was scaring me, it didn't mean to scare me. It didn't even think that it could be seen, but there I was actually looking at it. And so it actually felt bad. And so the whole crossing of the arms thing was a way to kind of put me into a self-hug. I got to see, it was from a different perspective, I got to see it kind of pat me on the wrists, the kind of a reassurance thing. And then it got out of there so that it would stop scaring me. So it was a really, really different perspective. And then, of course, she asked some questions to this being, like, you know, who are you? Why were you there? What are you doing? That sort of thing. And basically the summation of it was that this was a being from another space. She asked, you know, do you mean another dimension? And said, well, you might call it another dimension, but you know, really it's another space, which is kind of an interesting take on, we might not exactly know what dimensions are. And then you know, basically was there on a research mission from this other dimension, other space, and was essentially assigned to my house that night to study a human child. And once it figured out that I was awake and I could see it and it was scaring me, it got right out of there.
So one thing that I wonder about this is if it's some kind of other being, consciousness from another space, as it says, then why is it human shaped? Why has it got two arms and two legs and a head? Have you got any ideas about that?
I mean, that was the form it took. That was who it was, and not necessarily human, but some sort of other bipedal being or entity, if you want to call it that. So yeah, we didn't really get much information about its race at all, but yeah, some other bipedal being.
I talked to somebody who was having contact experiences, you know, abductions, and he was saying that at one point one of the greys communicated to him that what they look like is imprinted upon them by us, and that where they come from, they're not actually physical. And I was just thinking about that shadow person you saw. Maybe there's something to do with your consciousness and perception that may have formed it like that.
I mean, it could be. Again, if we're talking about something that's from another dimension, we don't have the correct geometry to be able to fully understand what that is. So, again, our eyes can only see into a certain narrow band of the entire spectrum. So when these other things from other dimensions cross into our plane of existence, they're not going to fully look like to us what they really are. So an example I use in the book, Travels Through Time, use the Flatlander example. So basically a two-dimensional civilization where everything is just, it's flat because it's 2D. So everything would be just kind of basic square, rectangle, circle, triangle, those sorts of shapes. Could even be a trapezoid, but they're going to be completely flat. But you take a three-dimensional sphere and you just kind of drop that right into Flatland. You have it just pass right through Flatland. And those Flatlanders, those two-dimensional people, they're not going to see, you know, the entire three-dimensional sphere. What they're going to see as this sphere passes through is they're going to see a circle open up, and as it, you know, reaches the full circumference of the sphere, as it drops through, it'll become a really wide circle. And then as it continues to pass fully through, that circle gets smaller and smaller until it disappears. But that's all they're really, because they only have the geometry to see the two-dimensional aspect of it. That's all they're going to really have an idea of what it might have been. They won't fully grasp the entire sphere of it. So it's kind of the same thing with us, is some of these other beings that are coming from other dimensions, we are not going to fully grasp what they specifically look like because we don't have the proper geometry to recognize it all.
And it's interesting, it was surprised that you could see it, which kind of suggests that it's been around a lot and you hadn't seen it before. So they could be around all of us right now.
I do believe there are many things around us that we cannot see with our eyes. Right? There's plenty of that. So, I mean, that's possible. The feeling that I got was that it wasn't necessarily, you know, assigned to my house, like as a full-time position, for lack of a better term, that it was just there that one of you, because we lived there 10 years and this was the only incident that ever occurred. Maybe it had been there other times that just didn't recognize or know about, but it didn't seem like it was always coming to my house and not like a recurring assignment, but yeah.
Yeah. Also, wasn't there a time you saw a shadow person in a kitchen?
That particular story was, and that was more of like a time slip incident, but it was a story that was related to me about a young man when he was a small child. He had walked into the kitchen one day, saw a tall, dark, hooded figure there standing by the kitchen table, scared him to death, and he ran out of the room. Years later, he's grown up, he's a young man now, and he's in the kitchen at the table making a sandwich. He's wearing a hoodie, and all of a sudden, he sees walking through the kitchen door this small, short shadow being, which stops and then, boom, darts right out of there. And it just hits him like, oh my gosh, that wasn't me, or I'm sorry, that wasn't a shadow person that I saw when I was younger. It was actually me at two different points in time, but it came off as a shadow. And then the question becomes, okay, why did he see it as a shadow and not himself fully formed? And I believe that because that has to do with, everything's energy, resonance, frequency, vibration. He just wasn't fully tuned into it at the time. So you think kind of like with a radio, you know, these days you can kind of click through, even though we still use knobs, you can kind of click through the stations, kind of click through the numbers in your car. But, you know, back in the day, you had to like really fine tune that band to get the station perfectly correct. If you're a little bit before, a little bit after, it would come in kind of fuzzy and distorted. And I think kind of the same thing here. He was able to tune into his own energy at that moment, but not fully. It was a little bit off. And so it just came off as a shadow.
I wanted to ask you about time slips and particularly mm-hmm. the Conjuring House.
Yeah.
Was there a woman there who saw some people having dinner?
Yeah, what was going on there? So the Conjuring House, give your listeners some context here. This is the Perrin household, the historic farmhouse that the first Conjuring movie was based off of, which really most of the Conjuring movie was fiction. They had the names right, and that was probably about it. Took place in Rhode Island. I think they got that part right. But so, you know, it was not a it was not a demonic possession and an exorcism that happened there. The involvement with the Warrens was really a seance that had gone bad. And this particular night is the Warrens were trying to communicate with the spirits of the household. They held this seance. And during that, Carolyn, the mother, got thrown backwards from the dining room into the parlor. And then she was kind of knocked out cold. And then Roger kicked the Warrens out of the house. And that was it. That was the end of the Warrens' involvement. And that was 1973. And the parents lived there for another 7 years and continued to have all kinds of hauntings and interactions, including a couple months later after that incident. The eldest daughter, Andrea, was up doing homework in the parlor, and Carolyn had woken up and asked Andrea for a little assistance, if she could heat her up some of the leftover stew from that night and put on a short pot of coffee. So Andrea goes and she's taking care of that. And Carolyn sits down in the parlor and is looking out into the dining room area. And as she's sitting there, she sees morph into existence a family out of the 1700s. So there's a woman cooking over an open hearth, which the fireplace in that room had been, at that point in time, had been boarded up for about 100 years. It's since been unboarded, but at that point it was boarded up. But there it is open, and there's a fire going, a woman's cooking over it. A couple of kids running around, and there are two gentlemen sitting at a table with pewter steins. And they turn and they look at Carolyn and they acknowledge that she's there. And the one gentleman kind of elbows the other and nods over at Carolyn and says, "Well, would you look at that?" As if Carolyn was the ghost. And then the whole scene kind of dissipated away. So it was really amazing. Two points in time, you know, getting a glimpse of each other and really acknowledging each other that they exist.
It's a thing. It's like, would you call it some kind of a bubble or something, or portal or something, that periodically kind of shows up?
Yeah, Andrea calls it at times like a bubble when they would be upstairs in the bedrooms, which, by the way, is right above the parlor. And then all of a sudden, some strange paranormal or supernatural activity would be going on. And it would seem like it would last for, you know, something like 20 minutes. And then finally would subside. They'd go downstairs, you know, shocked at everything that they had just experienced. And only 5 minutes had passed. So, yeah, there was some sort of interesting time bubble that would occur there. I've gotten in that specific area when I was filming my docuseries, The Shadow Dimension. I got really lightheaded up in that area. There's definitely some sort of strange energy, something going on there. And I think it all still stems from the well room in the basement, which is directly under the parlor. And most of the really significant activity in the house, you can kind of just look at the well and go straight up and it's all there. And what the well room is, I mean, it's called that because, yes, there's a well there. It's still an open well, still has water in it. They don't use it anymore. It's not like anybody's drinking from that anymore. But so we have a hole in the ground, open with water in it. The walls of that room are made of limestone and they're capped with granite blocks. So it's really like a perfect little power plant, limestone and then granite being wonderful conductors of electromagnetism. And then you have this hole in the ground with water, which also be a fantastic conductor of electromagnetism. So we see construction like this out in ancient Egypt. So yeah, perfect little power plant to be charging everything that's going on there.
And do you feel that these time slips are related to the Mandela effect?
Well, where I think the Mandela effect comes into play is, you know, we have some people that have traveled through time, whether it's physical or their consciousness. I think time travel will have, you know, real time travel has more to do with consciousness, and changes are made. And we're seeing that play out into things like the Mandela effect, where you have, you know, millions of people across the world that remember some of these past events very, very differently. Now, you go online, you look up Mandela effect, you'll find these top 20, top 50 lists of, you know, all these, you know, strange, a lot of it is branding. You know, people remember some of the different brands and spellings and things like that differently. And I'll just say on that note, nobody is going back in time to change the spelling of Fruit Loops or Oscar Mayer. I mean, that's just too trivial. but something could certainly be happening where somebody does go back in time and they could just be there, you know, watching and observing, not trying to interact with the environment, but just their presence there and any subtle little interaction that they have with the environment can cause changes and cause that ripple effect over time where, you know, it could drastically affect other things in the far future. And just, you know, take for instance, okay, you know, I'm crossing the road. Say I'm a time traveler. I'm just crossing the road to get to the other side because there's something down the street that I want to take a look at. And there's a car that was about to turn. It has to stop for me. And now that changes maybe 10 seconds of his trajectory of where that car was going, which may affect later on down the road. Maybe he was supposed to get into an accident. Maybe he's avoiding an accident now. You know, all those kinds of things that, to me, I'm just walking across the street, but could have other dire consequences for others within the timeline. And then that shifts as you get push it further and further down the road.
And wasn't there a film that you and your mother remembered and you couldn't find it?
Yeah, that was a really interesting one. You won't find that on any of the top 20 or top 50 lists, unless they started adding it since I've shared the story and put the book out. But I haven't seen it in any of those lists yet. Yeah, the movie. Well, let me start it with this. So some years back now, I think it was around 2016, I'm at my parents' house and, you know, we're having dinner, conversation, all that, and talking about some of my work that I'd been doing in the paranormal field. And my mom brings up a movie that she and I had watched several times when I was a kid. It was an older movie, black and white, about a crew of pilots from or an airship crew from World War II, that their plane had crashed in North Africa, and essentially they had died. And the way that we remembered this story is they didn't know that they were dead, and they were basically playing baseball, waiting for somebody to come and rescue them. But they were actually ghosts. This is kind of why I remember they were the ghost base, ghost Army Air Corps baseball players. And so we were trying to remember what in the world the name of that movie was, and we couldn't. So I told my mom, you know what? I'll go home tonight. I'll look it up and I'll tell you what the movie was, and maybe we can find it and watch it. So I go home that night and I run a search on the film, and I can't find it, and I can't find it. And I'm like, what in the world? Why is this so hard to find this film? And finally, and it was like a forum on aviation films, I find a discussion between several people on there where others are trying to find this film, and they're describing it like I did, old black and white movie, maybe from the like 1950s or early 1960s, talking about the ghosts and playing baseball and all that stuff. And other people can't find it. So some people on the board are suggesting that, well, maybe you're remembering an old Twilight Zone episode. Like, no, it wasn't that. Then others were suggesting that we were misremembering the movie Soul Survivor, starring William Shatner. And it's like, no, Shatner was not in this thing. You know, this was a movie from, again, like the late 1950s, early 1960s. And looking up this movie called Soul Survivor with Shatner, it was like 1970. And in color. And it's like, no, this cannot be that movie. But just to see what's going on with this film, I put it on and I start watching it. And, again, at first as I'm watching, I'm like, there's some elements that are true. Like, okay, they're, the plane has crashed and they're playing baseball, but they knew right from the very beginning that they were dead. Again, it was in color. And then, there's Shatner running around all over the place as one of the army officers of this salvage team. And it's like, there's some elements that ring true and others that just, this just doesn't seem right. But it gets to this one point in the film where one of the crew members, and he was a little mentally slow, we'll just say that. And he ventures off over toward the tents where the salvage team is at, and they have a baseball game on. So he's listening to the ball game and comes back over later on to his buddies that are hanging out by the airplane. And they ask him, well, what'd you think of the game? How was the game? And he was like, oh, it was a good game, but, I don't get it. How did they move Brooklyn to Los Angeles? And the way he said it was like he thought they moved the Dodgers moving from Brooklyn to L.A., but he said it as if he thought they moved the entire city. they moved all of Brooklyn to Los Angeles. And I remember that line as a kid because I played baseball as a kid. And I remember finding that line funny as a kid. And it was like, now watching it, I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is that movie. I distinctly remember that line. This is it. So it just blew my mind that, here it was all these years later that, my mother and I remembered it a specific way. All these other people that were on this forum remembered it the same exact way that she and I did. And these are people from all over the world. And yet upon watching it, it's different. So something happened. Something happened to change that movie. And not that anybody went back in time to specifically change that movie, but something happened in the timeline where that movie ended up getting produced later, and a little bit of the storyline was altered as a result of that.
It's weird, isn't it? I had a weird thing myself once where I was driving to work, and I go do this commute every day, and I saw that my favorite Chinese restaurant had had a fire. and the whole of the front of the restaurant was destroyed, and you could see all the black soot up the front of the building, and the windows were all boarded up. And I was like, oh man, that's my favorite Chinese place. And I drove past it for a few days, and then one day I drove past it and it was back to normal. And I thought, oh, well that was great. They did a really fast job on that. But then in the evening I was driving home past it, it was back with the windows boarding up and all the soot on the wall outside. And I was thinking, I didn't imagine it this morning. That was definitely back to how it was before. And it's my favorite Chinese restaurant. It wasn't just some random shop that I didn't really know or pay attention to. So that I've always remembered that, and I've never had an explanation for it, but I'm sure that's how it played out.
Yeah. Yeah. That's bizarre. And since you have an emotional tie to it, you're going to notice that. It's going to stand out to you. So the fact that, yeah. So something happened. Yeah. Something happened in the timeline, apparently a couple times, burned once. Then now it's not burnt, and then it's burnt again. So yeah, very, very strange. But yeah, to me, that's some manipulation going on in the timeline, the result of people having traveled back in time.
What is stacked time theory? That's in the title of your book.
Yeah. Stacked time theory. I have to back up a little bit here. When we talk about time and the nature of what time is, time doesn't really exist. In our conversation, we've been talking about the fourth dimension being time. But really, it's the fourth dimension is where our consciousness resides. And what's fascinating about humans is, you know, we are multidimensional beings. So our fourth dimensional consciousness is inside our third dimensional body. And so therefore, when we lose the body, the consciousness is still there. That's a whole discussion for another time. But time is just it's a human construct. It's something that we have created to describe our reality. It helps to keep track of things like when to plant the crops, keep track of the seasons, when to show up at work at the right moment so that our supervisors don't get upset with us, that sort of thing. It's a method of keeping track of things. But time itself actually does not exist. And when we get into this idea of other dimensions, we talked before about there being up to 11 hyperspatial dimensions. Those that are above us, 5, 6, 7, 8, they view time as a complete object, just like we view the things around us right now as whole objects. So you have access from your dimension to all the other ones below you. So we have access to the first dimension, which is a line, second dimension, which is a plane, third dimension, which is rudimentary cube, but basically all the objects around us. And then we reside on the fourth. So same thing for all the other dimensions above us. A couple different ways to look at this is, and we talk about that analogy of the river of time. And that's a good one. So, time is running downstream, time being the water. But the water doesn't make itself run, okay? What makes the water run in a river is you have these banks that are holding it in place. If you were to remove the banks, then all the water would spill out and would become stagnant, like a giant pond or lake or that sort of thing. And you could kind of at will move about from one point in the lake to another. You can also look at it as, take a town that you're driving through. Maybe there's a couple of houses, a store, a gas station, those sorts of things. And maybe, you drive through it at 35 miles an hour. It takes you 5 minutes to drive through it. So you have a time relationship with the town. When all of a sudden instead you're flying over it, you look out your window and the whole town is right there in front of you. So the stores, the house, the gas station, all that is all in your view. So what you once had a time relationship with, you now have a relationship in space because it's all there at once. So that's kind of the same thing we start talking about these other dimensions, that what is below the dimensions that are below theirs, they see all as a whole. So if all time is here, all time is concurrent, past, that means where you're sitting right now past, present, future, everything that has happened, is happening, and will happen, all there right now. And I liken each of those moments that are there as like a photo in a giant stack of photographs. And when we were talking time slips earlier, that's really like two of those moments, two of those photos in that giant stack resonating at the same frequency for just a moment. And that's where they're able to get a glimpse of one another, because being on the same frequency for a moment like that, they're able to kind of bleed into each other and get that glimpse of each other.
I was talking to Russell Targ the other day. We recorded an episode, and he was telling me about this time this remote viewer called Pat Price was viewing a location, and he talked about these two water towers. And they looked at the location. There weren't any water towers, but they did some research and they found that 100 years ago, it was a water treatment plant. So he was remote viewing back in time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And Pat Price was very, very talented and died very mysteriously as well. But yeah, when you're doing something like that, you know, your consciousness at that moment, yeah, we can certainly view something on this point in time, but you know, you enter into different brainwave states when you start meditating, remote viewing, while you're sleeping. And so, you know, your consciousness, when it's floating like that, it can move into different moments in time. So yeah, Pat Price viewing another moment in time at that location is not surprising to me at all.
And that leads me on to precognitive dreams. What's your view on them?
Yeah, I've had many myself. Yeah, precognitive dreams, premonitions, deja vu. To me, these are all a type of time travel. I mean, it's not us purposefully going to a point in the past or a moment in the future to play around or to watch and observe. It's something that kind of happens to us, and you know, we get that glimpse of something happening in the future, and then all of a sudden it's, you know, a day, a week, a month later, whatever it is, and it plays out. You're like, wait a minute, I just had a dream about that. Well, yeah, your consciousness had actually moved into the future for a moment, brought that knowledge back with you. Deja vu are kind of like those little snippets, because we don't always fully remember our dreams when we come back, and we kind of do this all the time. You got to tell someone, oh, I had this, you know, crazy dream last night, and this happened and that happened, and then wait, what? You don't quite remember it all. So I think those deja vu moments are like those really tiny snippets that that you get to that place and you're like, this is really familiar. It was like a snippet out of a dream, but it was a precognitive dream.
The book's called Travels Through Time: Inside the Fourth Dimension, Time Travel and Stacked Time Theory. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yeah, yeah. Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I mean, basically anywhere books are sold, you can find that. You can go to my website, mikericksecker.com, and I have that linked up there as well.
Can you tell us about your other books?
This one's the 13th, so I have plenty more. The one before this was Alaska's Mysterious Triangle, which gets into all of the strange phenomena that happens there in Alaska. Prior to that was A Walk in the Shadows, which is my research on shadow people. And then I have a whole other set of books on basically paranormal history, strange occurrences, things like that, and even a couple of mystery novels in there.
Well, it's been great having you on the podcast. Thanks for coming and doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Simon. It's been a great conversation.
And that was an interview with Mike Ricksecker about his book, Travels Through Time: Inside the Fourth Dimension, Time Travel and Stacked Time Theory. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. And what about this idea of timelines, where perhaps you could kill your grandfather and that just creates another timeline?
Yeah, I'm not so much on board with the whole we're splitting off into all these different multiple...